Thank you. Thank you, Fang, for the introduction. I'm very happy to be here to give this talk on my recent work on entanglement entropy in theory due to high derivative gravity. So as we all know, entanglement is basically a measure of quantum correlations. If we have any quantum system where we can divide the Hilbert space into two subsystems, say A and A bar, then we can trace over the degrees of freedom in A bar and get a reduced density matrix for A, and the entanglement entanglement entropy is then given by the area of this minimal surface divided by 4 g Newton. This is an important result for two different reasons. One is that entanglement entropy is usually a complicated quantity to compute in a generic quantum field theory or for a generic choice of the subsystem A. Sometimes it can be numerically computed, but analytic results are rare, at least. And in a strongly coupled field theory, it's simply out of a lot of numerical or analytic control. But this formula tells us that in a holographic theory, there is a very easy way to proceed, which is to compute some classical geometric data in the bulk. And this is much easier to computing some density matrix and taking the log and then the trace. So this is the practical reason for why it's interesting. It's also conceptually interesting because one might think that if we understand all these entanglement entropies for arbitrary regions, then we can hope to reconstruct the bulk metric and even reconstruct the bulk. So it is very tantalizing to use this idea to see how the bulk space is derived from ADS-CFT. Recent years, it has been, especially this year, has seen a lot of progress in understanding this simple formula. It was first noticed that this trivially satisfied strong subadditivity, a consistent check, and also it recovers exact results that we know for a single interval in 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT. In this case, the entanglement entropy is completely fixed by the conformal symmetry. It was first derived for a special case, which is when the boundary of A is a sphere. It was derived by Myers, Cassini, and Huerta, where they noticed that there's a U1 symmetry that allows one to transform the problem of computing the entanglement entropy into the problem of computing a black hole entropy for a certain topological black hole in ADS. And earlier this year, it was proven for 1 plus 1 dimensional CFTs in general. In general, I mean two or more, we can consider arbitrary number of disjoint intervals using either field theoretic techniques in terms of conformal blocks or by using gauge gravity duality. And perhaps quite remarkably, it was also derived generally in arbitrary dimensions for Einstein gravity by Aitor Ndukojic and Juan Maracena this April. And going beyond this formula, one can consider one-loop corrections in the bulk. As we know, this formula is a large N result. It is a leading result in the large N limit. And one can ask, what is the leading one over N corrections to that? And this can be done in certain cases by computing one loop corrections in the bulk. In particular, we did that for the 2D CFT case. And also, one can there's a proposal of high spin of holographic entanglement entropy for the case of high spin gravity by Nabil here and other people. Where the proposal is, instead of computing the minimal surface and its area, you simply compute a Wilson line, which is a gauge invariant quantity. So that's a very natural generalization in that case. It is very natural now to generalize this formula to the case of high derivative gravity. By that I mean, for example, contractions of Riemann tensors in the Lagrangian bulk. This is important, at least for the following reason. For a practical reason, at least, we can imagine that we want to use gauge gravity duality to study a lot of CFTs. And Einstein gravity for example, let's consider 4D CFTs. 4D CFTs can, in general, have two central charges, A and C. Einstein gravity gives A equals C in the large N limit. But if we want to get some field theory where A and C, the two central charges, are different, we can include high derivative terms in the Lagrangian. So this is at least to have a more generic possible field theory, one needs to include this corrections in the bulk. These are alpha prime corrections in string theory. So string theory already tells us that these are there. So it's important to have some formula which captures these corrections. And one might think that we should be looking for something which replaces the area in the Ruta-Kyanagi formula. This is rather analogous to how the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in the case of black hole is generalized to the Ward entropy in the case of high derivative gravity, where the Ward formula is simply that you take the Lagrangian and take a single derivative with respect to the Riemann tensor, contract it with the epsilon tensor, where this epsilon is defined in the following way. So remember, this entropy formula is evaluated on the black hole horizon. The horizon is a codimension 2 surface. So it has two orthogonal directions. Epsilon is defined to be the epsilon tensor in those two orthogonal directions and to be zero in all other directions. So this is a very nice formula. It was proposed by Ward in 93. This is for black hole entropy. For entanglement entropy, we actually have two independent, sort of independent questions. One is, what is the formula that gives the entropy? And second, can we find the analog of the minimal surface by minimizing, for example, the entanglement entropy, by minimizing the same formula? So I'll talk about both questions in sequence. I review what we currently know already from literature. We know that in general, the Ward entropy alone cannot be the entanglement entropy. Yes? We know it cannot be the entanglement entropy because it does not produce, in general, the right universal terms in the entanglement entropy. And actually, for the black hole case, you might think Ward entropy is the most general, most natural candidate for the entropy, but there's actually a different formula due to Jacobson-Myers in 93, and the formula is valid for Lovelock gravity, a particular class of higher derivative gravity. These two formulas are different, but they're only different by terms that involve the extrinsic curvature. So in the context where they were derived, where they were both derived, the horizon was a Keeling horizon, and the difference is zero. So actually, they are free. However, when we compute entanglement entropy, in general, the minimal surface or the analog of the minimal surface do not have vanishing extrinsic curvature. And therefore, we need a prescription for those terms, at least. These people found that for Gauss-Monnet gravity, which is Lovelock theory at four derivatives, the Jacobson-Myers entropy seems to at least pass consistency checks. It gives the right universal terms, so it could be the right answer. It could be the right prescription for the extrinsic curvature terms. So the main result of my talk is to propose the following general formula. The formula is a little bit more complicated than the Ward's formula. Instead of going through the detailed notations, I just say that the first term is exactly the Ward's formula for black hole entropy, and second terms are terms that involve extrinsic curvatures. And in a certain sense, I'll talk about how one can think about these terms as anomalies. It reproduces the existing results. For example, it does give back exactly the Jacobson-Myers story, the proposal for Lovelock gravity, and also it has the minimization prescription, at least for three non-trivial examples. I mention here that even though I started this project by thinking about mostly in the entanglement entropy, this formula and its derivation also applies for black hole entropy, in which case the formula is simply evaluated at the horizon. So this, in principle, this could be a generalization of Ward's formula when a horizon is not a Keeling horizon. So one can ask very interesting questions about how this, for example, satisfies the second law and so on, which I think are very interesting questions. For now, for the most part of the talk, I'll still talk about in the context of entanglement entropy, just for concreteness. There are a lot of recent developments in understanding the entanglement entropy in special cases for this formula. So for example, people have studied Gauss-Monnet theory and general general for derivative gravity and so on. So this formula reproduces these special results, which is, I think, very nice. So the outline for the rest of the talk is I'll first review the derivation of the Ruta-Carnacki formula in the case of Einstein gravity, just to lay the ground, the basic strategy for its generalization to higher derivative case. And also, I want to say it in a way that I think is particularly clear how we think about these analytic continuations. And next, I'll talk about how to derive and see this formula for higher derivative gravity. The minimization of the formula comes next, and at the end, I'll conclude. There are three examples so this formula is for the general case, but whenever we talk about something abstract, it's nice to have examples in mind, and these are the three examples I are mostly focused on throughout the talk.
Remind us of Lovelock.
Yeah, Lovelock gravity is a particular contraction of, say, P Riemann tensors. And I can write down the Lagrangian in a moment. One can use the generalized delta function to write down the Lagrangian. So maybe I can show that later.
It's the most general theory of gravity that has only two derivatives in the equation.
Yes, that's right. So the first part is a review on the derivative of the Ruta-Carnacki prescription for Einstein gravity. In a lot of the majority of the analytic discussions of the entanglement entropy, we usually use the replica trick. We introduce the Rényi entropy by defining it to be the trace of log of trace of rho to the n. And then the entanglement entropy is n goes to 1 limit of the Rényi entropy. The Rényi entropy is useful in the sense that at integer n, it can be written in terms of partition functions. So it's important to note that the entanglement entropy involves a log, which cannot easily be written in terms of the partition function of some local action. But Rényi entropy at integer n can be written like that. And the partition function is defined on a particular space called the n-fold cover. The construction of the n-fold cover is like follows. You can take n copies of the original space. So we always work in Euclidean signature. So let me first rotate to Euclidean signature and make n copies of the original space. This is a two-dimensional example. Then in the region I want to compute the entanglement entropy, I'll cut it apart on each copy, and then I'll glue them together in a cyclic way. This essentially extends the range of this angular coordinate tau from 2 pi to 2 pi n. So it goes around until it comes back only after n copies. And if we compute the log of the partition function on this n-fold cover, we can get the Rényi entropy for integer n. And let's just call these n-fold cover Mn, so the original space is M1. This is just a name, so I can refer to it better. The n-fold cover itself does not really make much sense to at non-integer n. It can only be defined for integer n. The crucial observation of Lukoyich and Matsena is that the holographic dual side provides a much better analytic continuation. So let's consider that. We can always, for the n-fold cover as the boundary, we can always build a bulk geometry as in the ADS-CFT description. We can then compute the partition function on the n-fold cover by computing the Unschel classical action on the bulk geometry. This is the prescription for ADS-CFT. So the basic idea is we can use this to compute the action, and then we might want to analytically continue it to non-integer n, and eventually we expand in linear ordering n minus 1 and extract the entanglement entropy. This procedure is very complicated in general. In particular, it requires explicit knowledge about the partition function or unshell action of the dual of the n-fold cover, it can be explicitly worked out in certain cases. But in general, it might be very complicated. The observation is that we don't really need these guys explicitly. If we can somehow analytically continue the bulk geometry in a certain sense, then we can just analyze the bulk geometry near n equals 1. And we can do some sort of expansion in the geometry itself and plug in some formula and get entanglement entropy. So this is true if we can find a family of bulk configurations that interpolates between the dual of the n-fold cover to non-integer n.
Yeah. So there are many examples by now where we know analytical continuation fails because if you approach from n 1 plus epsilon, you get some answer, and if you do n 1 minus epsilon, you get some other answer. So there are some simple features people have studied in the last several years. So if I take those theories, is there similarity in the action? It is bulk action?
I think
at n is equal to 1.
I think in the particular case, for example, Tom Faulkner studied in a particular case of two plus two dimensions, one can explicitly write down the result and check whether. So it is true that whenever we analytically continue a function which is only defined on the set of discrete numbers to a set of real numbers, there's an ambiguity. One can in principle fix that by imposing boundary condition of the entanglement entropy of the reigning entropy Sn as n goes to, say, plus minus I infinity. This is a formal procedure to get rid of the ambiguity.
But we can ask this question that whether trace rho log rho equals, trace rho log rho is a well-defined function. So it doesn't, there's some answer which is the answer.
Yes.
So does this answer always matches this n?
Is
it guaranteed to match?
I think my answer is if the boundary condition for n goes to plus minus I infinity is correctly imposed, then you always get the right answer.
It's a whole complex plane, not just those two directions.
There could be a statement about how the real particles behave. I think for real part which is bounded and imaginary part go to, as long as it doesn't blow exponentially, it's okay. But I think with the right boundary condition, it is guaranteed to be the right, because the analytic continuation is guaranteed to be unique. And then there's an additional assumption. Indeed, there is an additional mild assumption that this function is actually an analytic function of n. And with those two, I think one can do this. But indeed, there are subtleties in both these assumptions. So right now, we are actually assuming that.
You're saying there are examples where it's demonstrably not an analytic function.
I think that's true. Here, we are taking the assumption it is indeed an analytic function. So in particular, there's nothing. It's in some sense a statement about the entanglement spectrum, but we can talk about that more in detail maybe afterwards.
So you're about to tell us that specific analytic continuation that approaches n equals 1 from above.
Yeah.
So if there were multiples, you'd be picking one specific one. So if it were just analytic up to n equals 1 and then something goes weird at n equals 1, and something else happens as you approach from below, you would say the right answer is to approach from above.
Yeah, but the worry is there's some non-analytic behavior at, say, n equals 3/2.
That could be an issue.
Yeah,
I think that's the worry. Let's for now assume that doesn't happen. So I think it's an interesting question to ask when those happens, in particular in the gauge gravity. In a holographic case, I don't know the answer, but. Right now, let's assume that this is an analytic function. Then one can, in principle, try to do this. So this can be thought of as the assumption into the derivation of the formula. There is another assumption which I haven't mentioned, which is the replica symmetry. So in order to proceed, we need to make an assumption about the bulk geometry. It is a fact that the n-fold cover, the boundary side, has a Zn symmetry, which just cyclically permutes the n copies. So tau goes to tau plus 2 pi. It is an assumption that this Zn symmetry is not spontaneously broken in the bulk. So the bulk geometry also has the symmetry. I think right now it agrees with particular calculations. It's not clear how general this assumption will hold. And I would also leave it as an open question to investigate more what this means when it is indeed broken, for example, for the dominant saddle. So the idea is the dominant saddle point in the bulk geometry is one where you have a Zn symmetry. Then with this assumption, we can consider an orbifold, which is you mod out the solution by Zn, and let me call that B hat, where B refers to the parent space. This space is interesting because it, as we will see, it admits a nice analytic continuation. The B hat n is a space which is good, which can make sense for arbitrary n. This is the plane. So this is the orbifold because it is regular except at the fixed points of Zn. And where are the fixed points? The claim is the fixed points form a codimension 2 surface. The way we can see that is on the boundary, the fixed points are simply, in this picture, is simply the two endpoints of the interval. In general, it's the boundary of the region A that you pick. And if we extend the tau coordinate into the bulk, then it's always the circle, it's always the point where the tau circle shrinks to zero size. And you have a codimension 2 surface. So we can look at this picture. You have a codimension 2 surface which ends at the boundary of A. And this should be the fixed points for the region for the Zn action. In general, this codimension 2 surface could be, for example, disconnected. Can have two intervals. It can be disconnected and so on. And it also is a conical defect with an opening angle 2 pi over n. The reason for that is we started with a regular space. Remember that we have to solve all equations of motion and bulk when we consider the parent space. So once we do an orbifold, we necessarily produce a conical space. This orbifold help us calculate the entanglement entropy because we can simply construct, by construction, we can write the classical action of the parent space in terms of n times the classical action of the orbifold. This is at the classical level, this is correct. So we are really using ADS CFT to translate some quantum quantity into at least in the large n limit into some classical quantity, and then we'll divide and conquering. So that's the main idea. And it is important to note that this S of B hat, this on-shell action for the orbifold, does not include any contribution from the conical defect. This is, in particular, we should not include any Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. We should not include any also delta function contribution from the conical defect. We should simply integrate to the defect, integrate, the, for example, the Einstein-Hilbert action all the way down to the, say, rho equals zero, where rho is the proper distance from the conical defect. And that's the right answer. The reason is in the parent space, this is a totally regular place. I should not include anything fantastic from that conical defect. So the prescription is that we have to reproduce the Rényi entropy at integer n, and therefore we should also take that prescription to be the right prescription for the on-shell action of the orbifold. It is not plausible that we can analytically continue this orbifold. So the reason we didn't analytically continue the parent space is because usually it changes topology as we change n. And for example, I don't know how to talk about fractional handles and fractional topology, but Bn hat always has the right, at least topology to be analytically continued. In particular, its boundary is always a single copy of the original space.
Does anything happen at n equals to, can you do this for n less than 1 as well?
I would think there is no objection to do that from doing
that's
that.
Even more regular.
Yeah. Well, it has a conical excess in that case.
Yeah.
Right. So one can still do that. Yeah.
And go over to n equals 0?
I'm not sure. So globally, locally, I don't see any problem. Globally, I'm not sure whether you can find a global. So the worry is at some point, maybe you stop finding a globally well-defined solution. But I don't know. I don't know whether where is the stopping point.
So when you say you want to analytically continue, what do you have? Are you basically just changing the deficit angle?
Yes, correct. Correct. Yes, that's right. So yeah, yes. So, thank you. Yeah, the deficit angle is 2 pi minus 2 pi over n, and we can just continuously tune that to get non-integer n. That's correct. While imposing the usual boundary condition at infinity at a UV boundary of ES. So the same boundary condition there, but with an addition with a conical defect of the right amount at this surface. So that's actually what I'm going to talk about next. So there are two ways to analytically continue this geometry, this orbifold to non-integer n. The first is what I just said, what I call the boundary condition method. It simply imposes an additional boundary condition at a conical defect while preserving all the other boundary conditions and just solve all the equation of motion. The boundary condition near the conical defect is something like this, where rho and tau are coordinates in the orthogonal directions. Epsilon is defined as 1 minus 1 over n, so the conical defect is 2 pi times epsilon, and there is some transverse geometry. It's just an unconventional IR boundary condition. And we can actually work this out and justify the form of the metric by first working out integer n, impose the Zn symmetry. That puts a constraint on what terms are allowed in the metric, in the expansion around this conical defect. And then we simply analytically continue that to non-integer n. So that's the right boundary condition. There's another way to think about this, which is sometimes more intuitive, but is actually equivalent, which is, we observe that we can replace the conical defect by a dynamical cosmic brain. The cosmic brain is codimension 2 and solves and has the right tension to create the right conical defect. So in this case, it has a tension proportional to epsilon. So here I'm writing out the action, which is the Einstein-Hilbert action in the Euclidean signature, plus a right tension of the cosmic brain. And we simply solve all the equation of motion. Let the brain fluctuate and back react on the geometry. The claim is at the end of the day, you're going to get the same thing as the previous method. And this is just a way of getting what the B hat geometry is. And there is the reason that this works, another way to think about this is cosmic brains are straight in a certain sense. And once they settle down on where they want to be and solve all the equation of motion, you can then take the geometry, take the cosmic brain out, make n copies, and glue them together and form a regular geometry. So at integer n, this is the way to think about how this relates to the replica trick. And then we can do this for an arbitrary n. So this is very similar to how we analytically continue a function. We construct another function using another way, which is more broadly defined, and we see that it matches with the old function at the place where they overlap. So where is, one may ask, what is the conical defect? It's very similar to the minimal surface already. It has the right topological properties anchored at the boundary of A. And in fact, it does become the minimal surface as n goes to 1. This is particularly easy to see from the cosmic brain method. In the cosmic brain method, we simply had an area term for the tension of the brain. And as n goes to 1, which is when epsilon goes to 0, we have a probe brain. So it does not back react on the geometry anymore to lean order in the approximation. And what it does is to settle at the minimal surface of the original geometry. So that's very clear. One can also see it from the one can also see the same effect from the boundary condition method. In this case, we simply look at a particular component, the zz component of the Einstein equation, where z is the complex coordinate in the orthogonal direction to the conical defect. The conical defect is the codimension 2 surface, and the orthogonal space is parametrized by z and z bar. So if we look at this component of the Ricci scale, Ricci tensor, it is proportional. It has a potentially power divergent term. This is the only term that could that can be potentially divergent as you approach the conical defect, and it is proportional to epsilon. So this is true at linear order in epsilon. And it's proportional to the trace of the extrinsic curvature. We expect that the stress tensor, we could have scalar fields and other matter fields in the theory, but we expect the stress tensor from those matter fields to be regular. One way to see this is in the parent space, certainly everything is regular everywhere in the bulk. And in particular, at a fixed point of the Zn symmetry, so nothing is diverging there, and we should expect that for general n, nothing is diverging also, and therefore the only possibility for the Einstein equation to be satisfied as we approach this conical defect is that this term has to vanish. There's no other term which can compete with this term in the equation of motion. So that means the trace of the extrinsic curvature is zero, and that's precisely the equation for a minimal surface. So that agrees with the more intuitive cosmic brain method. In both methods gives the minimal surface as n goes to 1. And we just have one last step to prove the Ruf-Takayanagi formula, which is we need to compute it. We can compute the entanglement entropy by simply taking the action, the unshell action of the orbifold, and expand to linear order in n minus 1 and extract the coefficient. Mm-hmm. And this is particularly easy because the variation of this unshell action to linear order in n minus 1 is mostly proportional to the equation of motion. If we try to do a first variation of the action, we get mostly the equation of motion in the bulk, plus boundary terms. But the equation of motion is satisfied at n equals 1. So it's 0. This is because we are varying away from a solution, so the linear variation, at least linear variation, is only a boundary term. And we can compute the boundary term. I won't repeat the calculation here. It's just a very explicit calculation. And one finds that it's given by the area of the minimal surface as n goes to the area of the conical defect as n goes to 1, which is the minimal surface, divided by 4g Newton. So this is for Einstein gravity. And in this step, as we will see, there is a subtlety analogous to anomaly that when we go beyond Einstein gravity. So this completes the derivation of the Ruf-Takayanagi formula. And let me just summarize what's involved. We construct the conical defect geometry by using either the boundary condition method or using the cosmic brain method. And then we look at the equation of motion or the brain action and fix the location of the conical defect as n goes to 1. And eventually, we calculate the variation to linear order and extract the entanglement entropy. So we can now generalize the story to high derivative gravity. In particular, I'll consider Lagrangians, which are built from contractions of Riemann tensors. And the formula is, as I said before, it's the Ward formula plus anomaly plus terms which involve extrinsic curvatures. So this term, this involves the z and z bar coordinate I defined earlier. One can write it in a more covariant but more lengthy way in terms of projection operators to the codimension to the orthogonal z and z bar directions and epsilon tensors in those directions. This is just the projection which imposes the zi, zj, z bar, k, z bar, l kind of structure. Here, I and j are coordinates along the conical defect. So this is just the same as this. Let's first ask why is there a term which I call the anomaly? It's simplest to use to look at the first non-trivial example, which is the contractions of two Riemann tensors. There is a term in this Lagrangian which goes as we this there is a term which is the ZIZJ component, which is potentially diverging. This is the same component we looked at a little bit earlier. It goes like epsilon over z times the extrinsic curvature. So if we have two of these guys in the Lagrangian, we potentially construct something which is second ordering epsilon, but also blows up as 1 over rho squared, where rho is the absolute value of z. So one might think that this term is not important because we're doing the linear variation in epsilon. Remember, epsilon is linearly the same as n minus 1. So this term, we would maybe naively say that we should throw it out. But actually, this secretly contributes to the variation of action at linear order once we integrate, because there is a logarithmic divergence when we set epsilon to 0. That really means we should keep track of all the powers of rho to the epsilon from other part of the integrand before doing the integral. And with those powers, this integral will be convergent. At rho equals 0, it will no longer be divergent if this number is positive. And this number actually and the final result is actually 1 over epsilon. So it enhances something which is quadratic in epsilon into a linear contribution. And entanglement entropy picks up that linear contribution at the end of the day. So this is very much similar. This 1 over epsilon kind of pose is very similar to the same kind of pose in dimensional regularization where epsilon is, for example, 4 minus d. It's the same story. And really, in order to compute in general, what is the right size of the contribution, it's easiest to use what I call the regularized cone method. Some people call it regularized squashed cone, just to emphasize that the cone is not U1 symmetric. So the idea is we are looking at the action of a conical geometry with a tip cut off. Remember, I don't want to consider any contribution from the tip. So I can fill in the tip by some regular geometry and subtract it off. This is always true. And then I can claim that the total action of this geometry without boundary has zero derivative at epsilon equals 0. This is because I'm varying epsilon equals 0 is the n equals 1 solution. It's a solution of all equations of motion. And since the entire thing is regularized and has no boundary, there is no linear contribution to the variation of the action. The variation of the action is completely proportional to the equation of motion, which is satisfied. So therefore the entanglement entropy, which is the epsilon derivative of the outside action, is just minus the derivative of the inside action.
So just to be clear, I mean, there are boundaries at infinity.
Yes.
You include the usual boundary terms.
Yes, the usual Gibbons-Hawking bound, the usual Gibbons-Hawking York bound, yeah. the boundary term is there to get rid of the boundary term there. Yes.
You're not including it for the conical.
Yes, yeah. And it's important that when we do this derivative, the boundary condition at the asymptotic UV of ADS is held fixed. So we are not incurring any additional boundary terms from there. This can be worked out in a very precise way. So the only contribution, so therefore, is from this procedure, it is clear that the only contribution to the entanglement entropy is localized at the conical defect. It's minus the derivative of the action from the inside of this cone geometry. This is rather analogous to how we use counterterms to deduce Brown anomaly. One can think about this as the renormalized effective action. This is the counterterm, and this is the total effective action. That this another story. There's an analogy to how we use the outside inside to compute this entanglement entropy, and in the Weyl anomaly calculation, there is a similar story where we use the same technique to analyze the effective action and counterterm. And it is also clear because logarithmic divergences are robust. This kind of we can actually use any regulator we want. The final result does not depend on the regulator. So we can just pick our simplest regulator, like putting an A in front of the warp factor. And this already smooths out the interior geometry, and we can do the computation. So we can just do the computation, and it's very clear that there are two kinds of contributions. There is one possible contribution if one Riemann tensor gives a delta function, or in this case, a regularized version of a delta function smeared in the inside of the cone. And the integral of that just picks up the coefficient of this component of the Riemann tensor. So in this example, it just picks up this term. And this is exactly what entropy. And there's another, as we said, there's another possibility of getting a linear term if we have a log divergence. This log divergence when you set epsilon to zero prematurely. And one can compute this in a very explicit way. I won't repeat that. And the final result will be something which precisely agrees with an earlier explicit computation by these people. And where they did the calculation in a rather explicit way, where they actually write down a particular metric with transverse space being cylinders or spheres and so on, and then fix the coefficient by computing the whole thing at arbitrary n and then analytically continue. So it's a much more complicated calculation than what I'm doing here. And it's nice to see this computation because it captures where the contribution is coming from. So I won't really try to completely derive the formula. It's rather easy to see that one now generally picks up, for the delta function, one just pick up the derivative of the Lagrangian. And for the second kind of contribution in general, one pick up, one needs a Riemann tensor that goes like Zi, Zj, and the other goes like its conjugate. And we simply take a second derivative of the Lagrangian. So there is a bit of counting. There is a counting parameter involved, which counts how many extra powers of rho to the 2 epsilon that appears in the second derivative of L. This is because we have a log divergence, and any powers of rho to the epsilon is important. We need to keep track of all of them. So in the conical geometry, we can actually expand in a lot of different components of the Riemann tensors. And for example, different components or different terms inside could have different powers of rho to the 2 epsilon because these factors appear in the metric. And I should actually count those. And the idea is we should expand this quantity for each different term which comes with different powers of rho to the 2 epsilon, Q counts the extra number of those vectors, and then we resum, use the weight use basically 1 over q alpha plus 1 for the weight. 1 comes from the power. There's already a rho to the 2 epsilon coming from the determinant of the metric, and as well as these two factors. So it's just some counting, some counting that one needs to keep track of. And for the sake of time, I won't go through the detailed prescription. There is a very explicit prescription for how to do the counting, because one can do a Gauss-Kadazi-like decomposition for different components of the Riemann tensor. And it turns out that the extrinsic curvature terms comes with different powers of rho to the 2 epsilon. And at the end of the day, you can just do this kind of decomposition and count the different terms that you have in each term. So this is something that can be done very explicitly for a given theory. For example, if you give me a Lagrangian, this is something which can be done very, very efficiently. And in particular, one doesn't really need to know what these R tildes are. One can write it out. It's not necessary for this purpose. If, for example, if you want your final result to be written in terms of the Riemann tensor and the extrinsic curvature, because what you do is you take possible components of the Riemann tensor in the second derivative of L, you decompose, and then you resum, use the weights, and then you can replace R tilde using this equation again and get some a final result, which is nice. So you don't really need to know what it is, although you can write it down explicitly. And in some sense, these Q alphas can be thought of as very loosely as anomaly coefficients.
So Q alpha is not just simply related to the power of the curvature that appears in the action?
No, it's not. For different terms, you get different. For example, let's consider this example. This is a Riemann tensor with all components along the
yeah, but your action's covariant, right? It can involve only certain components of the Riemann tensor. It always involves all components.
Yeah, that's right. So you should the prescription is you should write it out, expand it out, and with each term you might associate different cues. So the idea. So a very brute force way of doing this is you first figure out what this is, and then you expand out all the contractions. So you. For example, if there's a contracted index, it can either be in the I direction or A direction, where you have two types of directions. And you use these equations and figure out what the, for each term, which is a sum. So you get a sum of products of different terms like this. And for each term, now you can assign Q by counting how many guys there are in that term. And then you sum over alpha, where alpha counts different terms. So this is in principle, this can be done. And this is actually the right prescription for Lovelock gravity. And it's very sensitive to all these powers. In particular, if you look at this term, it is the intrinsic curvature plus products of two extrinsic curvatures. And it turns out this term does not come with any powers of rho. This term comes with powers of rho to the 2 epsilon. So you actually have q equals 1 for this term and q equals 0 for that term. This is the one example of how we count different weights of the different terms. So we can now compare it with existing results. For f of r gravity, it is sort of trivial. There is no anomaly, just the Watt's entropy, and we can see it by transforming it trivially to Einstein gravity plus scalar fields. One can immediately use it for four derivative gravity, where the general form of the Lagrangian is like this. And using the formula, one immediately works out something which agrees with also some with this paper. So the Lovelock gravity at four derivative is just, which is also Gauss-Bonnet gravity, is a special example of the previous one. And all the terms sums into the in terms of the intrinsic curvature of the co-dimension 2 surface. it agrees with Jacobson-Meyer's entropy. At six derivatives, there is no prior derivation for this. There is a conjecture that it might also be Jacobson-Meyer's, but it's just a conjecture. There is partial consistent check in this formula in this paper. Miraculously, our formula also gives the same Jacobson-Meyer's entropy. And actually, in general, level of gravity, one can prove it. One can prove that the formula is always the Jacobson-Meyer's entropy. And remember that Jacobson-Meyer's entropy is, if you write the Lavoisier-Lagrangian as this generalized delta function where all the upper and lower indices are anti-symmetrized, then the Jacobson-Meyer's entropy is simply the p minus 1 of these guys with the intrinsic curvature instead of the original curvature. So one can show this. This is sensitive to all those weights that I talk about, so it's a quite non-trivial check. So we used a generalized gravitational entropy method to derive something which is valid for higher derivative gravity, and it's important that we have to keep track of quadratic terms in the Lagrangian if there could be a logarithmic divergence at epsilon equals zero. This is the main point of my talk, and it agrees with existing results. There is a caveat in how we count this component of the in this possible expansion. Remember, Q is the derivative of K, so K appears linearly in the expansion of the metric. Q is a quadratic order. I just want to say very quickly that we made a particular but very natural assumption about the analytic continuation from the Zn symmetric metric to non-integer n. But it'd be nice to fix this more concretely. I think if you're interested, I'm happy to talk about it.
So could you remind us what the Myers-Jacobson description is?
It is this.
That's for Lovelock, right?
It is always for Lovelock. It's only for Jacobson-Meyer's can only be applied for Lovelock. So they didn't have unfortunately they don't have anything for non-Lovelock theory.
Okay. It looks like you could derive their prescription.
Yes. So precisely. The formula completely reproduces that in the case of Lovelock gravity.
How did they come up with this?
They use a Hamiltonian formalism because the Lovelock gravity has the interesting feature that the equation is second order. So one can use the Hamiltonian formalism and use the second law, basically. Derive something which obeys the second law.
Oh, you mean the first law?
Yes.
Sudipta Sarkar and I have a paper where we proved the second law for Ethel's law.
Yes.
That was later.
Yeah.
And you haven't mentioned it, but it agrees.
Yes. There is a proposal by Aaron about what is the generalization of the Jacobson-Meyer's to the case where the theory is not just Lovelock, but f of Lovelock. So any function of Lovelock, the Lovelock Lagrangian is this, so any function of this. And my formula actually agrees with their results. So this comes after I submitted the paper, so I was happy. So I'll just very briefly talk about how to evaluate, the minimization because in the sake of time. So maybe I started 5 minutes after. The idea is the location that we should evaluate this formula is in principle well-defined. It is in principle well-defined because one can one can solve the equation of motion, figure out where the conical defect is, and then analytically continue, and then take the limit and goes to one. So in principle, you can define it that way. But this is hard. This is difficult to find out, and it's not efficient. So it's very desirable to be able to find the location of the conical defect as n goes to one by some other way. In particular, it'd be nice if it can be determined from minimizing some function. In the cosmic brain method, we can ask a similar question. What is the cosmic brain action which produces the right conical defect in the theory of higher derivative gravity? This is the equivalent question. Once we find that, then minimizing that automatically gives the conical defect. So in particular, we can ask, can this simply be the same formula that we saw earlier? And we will see that by example. So in F of log gravity, this is, again, a sort of trivial example, because we can transform to Einstein gravity plus scalar field. And this indeed gives the right, minimizing this gives the right the surface for we to use this formula. There's a way to see this from the cosmic brain method, where we simply combine the this action with the brain action, where the brain action is simply the entanglement entropy, and we show that this gives the right conical defect. The way we show that is we look at the most singular terms in the equation of motion, and the most singular term is in the conical geometry is expected to be that one of the Riemann tensor contributes a delta function. So this is the equation, and one of these guys can contribute a delta function, and we can simply match the delta function in some sense, and derive the conical defect. So in general, this could be a strategy for deriving the cosmic brain action for general theory of high derivative gravity. In this case, it's particularly simple because everything is just a Ricci scale. For general four derivative gravity, one can also do this. So this is the Lagrangian, as we saw earlier, and this is the entanglement entropy. We can also show this use the cosmic brain method. There is, instead of going through the derivation, I just show how the extrinsic curvature terms comes out. The extrinsic curvature comes out because it actually is very similar to the previous derivation, but arises in a slightly different way. So we can consider the equation of there's a term in the equation of motion which looks like this, because one can have one of the Riemann tensor produces two derivative x on the other Riemann tensor, where the other Riemann tensor actually has this structure for these components. And then we actually have three derivatives acting on A. And it produces a single derivative on the delta function. So this delta function comes not from a single Riemann tensor which already produces a delta function, but from additional derivatives that acts on it. And the extrinsic curvature precisely produces, when they arise in the equation of motion, when they are put in the brain action, they gives an equation of motion which is precisely of this form. So one can also match them in order to convince yourself that this is the right cosmic brain method, brain action. In Lovelock gravity, it is actually quite simple now, because equation of motion is second derivative. We can actually use both methods. The cosmic brain method is much simpler, because there is no derivative acting on delta functions anymore. One can just check all the delta. One can just simply check coefficients of delta function without worrying about its derivatives, and this actually explains why the Jacobson-Mears entropy does not depend on the extrinsic data. It only depends on the intrinsic Riemann tensor. This is because if it had depended on something extrinsic, it would necessarily produce a delta derivative acting on the delta function, which cannot possibly be matched by the equation of motion in the in the original theory. So it sort of explains why this has to be the case. In the boundary condition method, it's actually a straightforward generalization of something that was done in August, where they considered Gauss-Bonnet gravity. So the idea is you simply look at, again, the component of the equation of motion. And because of the anti-symmetrized property of this generalized delta function, one immediately see that there is a component which is potentially diverging as you approach the conical defect. And imposing that the coefficient be zero is the embedding equation for minimizing the Jacobson bias entropy. So one can work this out very, very explicitly. So let me conclude. The main point of the talk is there's a formula that when we evaluate the conical defect defined as C1, it can give the holographic entanglement entropy for general high derivative gravity. And it consists of two terms, and it has very nice physical meanings. It agrees with existing results. And also in three examples, we've shown that minimizing the action gives the location of the conical defect. There is immediately a lot of open questions. One, it would be nice if we can show that minimizing the entanglement entropy always gives the conical defect. So I've shown it for three examples, but it would be nice that this is always true. Even if this is not true, one can find perhaps other efficient ways for locating the conical defect. Maybe one can always look at singular components of the equation of motion. And my opinion is that by looking at the right components, one can always extract the data to fix the location, although this might they may or may not arise as minimization of some functional. But that's, for practical purposes at least, that's good enough, because how do we use the minimization procedure? We go ahead and derive the embedding equation and solving them anyway. So if we arrive at some equation which determines the location, for practical purposes, we don't really care. It would be nice to generalize the formula to other cases where, for example, we have derivative of the Riemann tensor in the Lagrangian, which I haven't talked about. I think in this case, one just needs more bookkeeping, because derivatives hitting on the Riemann tensor basically asks you, in order to do that, one needs to expand the Riemann tensor to higher orders in the terms of in the expansion of the metric. So one needs to work more systematically. But I think the idea is still true, that one can go through the different terms in the Lagrangian and pick up those which either have a delta function or has the possible log divergences. It's always the log divergences which can be enhanced into a linear contribution. So, and also TMG, the topologically massive gravity, is another possible generalization. There's application to entanglement entropy in 60-dimensional CFTs, which I'm thinking about. There is also, I think there is also a lot of applications in black hole physics, which I want to think about either. And eventually, maybe, I don't know if there's anything useful we can say about one loop corrections, maybe there is. And eventually, we may want to covariantize this formula into a version where we can consider a general time-dependent case. One can, for the Ruta-Kanagi formula, there's a proposal that we can always just extremize the area in the Lorentzian background. One can perhaps do something. One can naturally conjecture that extremizing this formula could also give the right thing. But I haven't thought about that more than, in more details. So that's all I have. Thank you very much.
So, does this functional have any obvious geometrical meaning?
Geometric meaning? You mean other than the fact that it is constructed from the Riemann and the extrinsic curvature?
You're generalizing the area.
Yeah.
The area is nice.
Yeah, for a particular theory, it has, it sort of has geometric meaning. For example, for the Jackson-Myers entropy, it has a geometric meaning in terms of the intrinsic data on the surface. And in particular examples, one can see that, for example, this term is some Riemann tensor, or this term is some extrinsic data. But in general, I don't have a good one-sentence summary of what geometric meaning is, other than saying this is, in general, Riemann contractions of Riemann tensor and Ks.
Do you know if your formula is positive definite?
It's not clear. The short answer to that question is, one can first always add this to the Ruta-Kandavi formula, which means I always consider small perturbation from Einstein gravity by adding some higher derivative term with small coefficients to Einstein gravity. In that case, it is guaranteed to be positive definite from a perturbative sense. And when those coefficients, those coupling constants become large, I don't have a positive definite proof of this, and I don't really think there is, because in general you might expect problems such as ghosts, so you might expect that you only can really get unitary theory when those couplings are very special. And my conjecture is that when they admit something unitary, you can probably show that this is positive.
And also, at least from the point of view of string theory, no reason to neglect the derivative.
Precisely. That's why I want to generalize it to the derivative case. Yeah. So the idea is, if we look at full string theory, we should have to include all those. And once we do that, we get something which is perhaps non-perturbatively correct in alpha prime.
Obviously, it's negative for GR with a negative Newton's constant. So there have to be some constraints. Yeah.
Certainly.
So in the normal Ruta-Kandavi formula, the fact that you minimize something is sort of nice because it implies strong subadditivity.
Yes.
Immediately. So
yes.
Does that make you think that maybe you minimize something here too, or do you think strong subadditivity?
That's the main motivation for thinking about why minimizing this could be the right answer in the first place. But there are two ways to think there may be. It's not a huge problem if it doesn't really minimize the formula. First thing is that, again, without a particular structure of these higher derivative terms, there could be ghosts, and strong subadditivity does not necessarily hold. So you might expect that this doesn't always hold. It's nice that this holds in unitary theory such as the Lovelock theory, where it's second derivative, and also f of r, where it's trivially second derivative. And I think maybe the difficulty in proving a minimization prescription in general is related to the fact that there could be ghosts, and the theory knows about that. There is another more technical answer, which is, even if you had some minimization prescription, as Aaron reminded me yesterday, in the proof of strong subadditivity, you basically look at two minimal surfaces, you look at two surfaces which intersect, and then you pull them apart. And in replacing those, in smoothing out that thing, the extrinsic curvature could, in principle, come in and make a difference. So in the Einstein gravity case, that doesn't matter, and you can immediately prove it. But in general, there's some subtlety. Again, you might expect those particular theories, you might still be able to do it. But in general, I don't have a concrete answer yet.